So, representing both the allure of the harem and the decadence of ancient Egypt, the female mummy came to be seen as a sexually appealing artifact in the late 19th century. Not in reality, but in literature and other art forms. This paper evaluates how the female mummy is reimagined and recontextualized, situated somewhere between erotic objet d'art and uncanny artifact. Statuesque in her perfection, she is often represented as constructed from precious materials in a bid to idealise her form and render her passive to the objectifying gaze. The first part of this paper examines the fundamental differences in the appearance of male and female mummies as they are described in late 19th century literature and accompanying illustrations, noting that male mummies are more likely to be depicted realistically as troublesome artifacts rather than the classical sculptures that female mummies often evoke. From there, I discuss female mummies in fiction of popular authors such as Arthur Conan Doyle, Bram Stoker, and H. Rider Haggard, noting the similarities in depictions of the female mummy that conform to a single physical ideal, as expressed in a number of Victorian paintings of ancient Egyptian women. Finally, I discuss the terrifying and exhilarating prospect of unwrapping and reviving these bodies, and these bodies' inevitable destruction. Unlike the perfectly preserved white female mummies that feature in sensationalist fiction with a more erotic emphasis, the male mummy, and the ancient Egyptian male in general, tends to show the realistic effects of time in his physical degradation and discoloration. And while there are exceptions to the rule, the ancient male mummy is almost always visually other. Male mummies in literature tend to be depicted at least semi-realistically desiccated and skeletal, as in this 1883 photograph by Félix Bonfils. And the gentleman on the left is a mummy seller, and standing next to him are two mummies, one swathed and one kind of unswathed and skeletal. So by the late Victorian era, mummies and mummy parts would have been very familiar in museums, private collections, and in public unrollings, which had been popular since the 1830s. A visit to Egypt, a popular winter destination for travellers seeking sunshine and high society, was incomplete without the acquisition of a mummy for installment in the home, or at least a more easily transportable mummy hand or foot. So in Arthur Conan Doyle's short story, Lot Number 249, published in 1892, which is incidentally the first ever tale involving a mummy reanimated to enact the reanimator's revenge, the unnamed mummy is described as withered and gaunt, and that's the original illustration that accompanied it when it was published. And the mummy, you can't really see it in that high quality, but there it is in the background, kind of with its arms and its glowing supernatural eyes. But this mummy is depicted at least semi-realistically in that it does look like a skeleton. And it's so inhuman, in fact, that it's only referred to as he by the man who resurrects it, and simply the thing, the creature, or it by the other characters. More animal than man, its strength and movement are likened to that of a cat, a tiger, and an ape at various points in the narrative. And the comparison between the mummy and an ape is particularly telling, as we get a sense of a sort of backwards evolution and a return to the primitive, which is something that comes up again and again in fantasy Eglar texts. So its features are also reminiscent of that other great Victorian monster, the vampire. It has two thin teeth like those of a rat, which hang over the bottom lip, and crooked, unclean tongues for nails. And so it exists in a state that combines realistic features of ancient decayed mummies with the supernatural and the animalistic. And so what comes across through Doyle's mummy is something which is the antithesis to the story's heroes, which are young, white, healthy British men. Doyle also wrote another short story with ancient Egyptian themes called The Ring of Thoth, which was published 2 years earlier, 1890. And that reveals the common differences between the ancient Egyptian male physique and the ancient Egyptian female physique as represented in literature. So that story tells the tale of Sosra, who's an ancient Egyptian priest, and he's discovered the chemical secret to extreme longevity. But he's also depicted as the physical embodiment of ancient Egyptian culture, with his parchment skin evoking Egyptian papyrus, and his dusky complexion the exact counterpart of the innumerable statues, mummy cases, and pictures within the Louvre. Sosra's representation is further linked to the museum exhibits through his cadaverous and corpse-like appearance. While he is not technically a mummy, he shares many of their bodily traits, including the visible signs of decay. In contrast, the mummy of the woman Sosra loves, Atma, remains for a time perfectly preserved and to an uncanny degree. Removing the bandages reveals long, black, glossy tresses, A low white forehead with a pair of delicately arched eyebrows, a pair of bright, deeply fringed eyes, a straight, well-cut nose, a sweet, full, sensitive mouth, and a beautifully curved chin. The catalogue of her attractive features reads like an idealised portrait, or particularly in descriptors such as well-cut, a statue. At the point of unwrapping, and already in one of the world's most famous art museums, the Louvre in Paris, Atma is more of an objet d'art than an artefact. Once kissed, however, Atma's body reacts to the air. Her skin disintegrates, the eyes sink into their sockets, and the lips and teeth visibly darken. So almost in a reversal of the kind of Sleeping Beauty fairy tale, which was first translated, I believe, in the 19th century into English, instead of the kiss awakening the beautiful, lifelike dead lady, she disintegrates, and the effects of time happen in that one kind of magical instant. Atma, perfect if just for a moment, echoes the depiction of the ancient Egyptian woman as she was portrayed in art, something common to many texts featuring female mummies. For example, in The Finding of Moses by Frederick Goodall, completed in 1862, Pharaoh's daughter stands with the elegant posture of a classical statue, her body shining with the luminous whiteness that contrasts with the darker skin tone of her attendants. And in The Death of Cleopatra by John Collier, estimated to have been completed around the year 1890, the Egyptian female is presented in a very similar way. Cleopatra, pale and majestic in death, wears nothing but transparent white fabric evocative of mummy bandages. These idealised and heavily westernised versions of ancient Egyptian beauty, in life and in death, evidently have made their impact on literature concerning the ancient Egyptian female. A parallel depiction of the female mummy can be read in Bram Stoker's The Jewel of Seven Stars, first published in 1903, and then reissued with an alternate ending in 1912. As Nina Auerbach has identified, there is an alluring conjunction of women and corpses present in literature of the fantasy epochle, mirroring late Victorian and early Edwardian society's increasing interest in the supernatural. I would add, however, that fiction concerning the ancient Egyptian female relies on this trope in a particularly significant way. The first part of Queen Terra's body subject to the gaze is her severed, seven-fingered hand, so perfect that it startled one to see it. The skin the colour of old ivory, and later described as being like marble. Torn from the mummified queen's body by Arab grave robbers, the hand's value is instantly recognisable, as it is taken along with other treasures from the tomb, and thus begins Terra's treatment as an object, to be modified and displayed by the novel's male characters. More sexually charged, perhaps, is the Egyptologist Trelawney's decision to install her body within his bedroom, itself museum-like in the sheer density of ancient Egyptian relics it houses. In a scene that's often compared to the sexualised staking of the vampire Lucy in Dracula, Terra's unwrapping is eroticised and overseen by a band of male professionals. Trelawney tries to justify his actions to his daughter by reminding her that Terra is not a woman, dear, a mummy, though his use of the feminine pronoun to refer to Terra suggests that he is all too aware of her womanliness. Her body is no mere artefact referred to as it or by its auction number as the male mummy in Doyle's Lot Number 249. Instead, it is inherently female, a unique artwork visually akin to precious materials. Underneath the outer wrappings, which have the appearance of the genuine artefact, darkened by dust, patchy and chipped, Terra's body conforms to the representation of the ancient Egyptian female nude as art. As Pia Paul Lipinski recognises, her body is both an erotic and exotic exhibit. The visible bone in Terra's wrist is likened to opal. So again, we see the uncanny transformation of the female body into precious materials. And once the rest of her body is revealed, it's described as being like a statue carved in ivory by the hand of Praxiteles. And I think Stoker's reference to Praxiteles, he's trying to get us to imagine a very specific image. And this is the very specific image, that statue. So Praxiteles was an ancient Greek sculptor, and he was the first artist to produce a life-size statue of a female nude. And that's it. The work is called The Aphrodite of Cnidos, and I think this is what Stoker wants us to imagine when we think of the mummified Terra unwrapped. And in the statue, we have the Aphrodite actually holding something, which looks as if she's just taken it off her body. So the statue actually kind of embodies an act of unwrapping. Strikingly, the description of Terra's face also shares remarkable similarities with Doyle's female mummy. Her hair is glorious in quantity and glossy black. She has a white forehead, eyes fringed with long black curling lashes, although Terra's eyes, unlike Atma's, are closed, nostrils set in grave pride, and full red lips behind which, tellingly, can be seen the tiniest white line of pearly teeth, again equating her with precious materials of artistic value. And I think it's quite impossible for people to read Stoker and read about a dead lady with full red lips behind which reside pearly white teeth and not think that this is an image of vampirism. But if it is an image of vampirism, it contrasts with Doyle's vampiric mummy with the rat-like teeth that hang over the bottom lip. This is an idealised and hypersexualised vampire rather than a rat-like monster. So the novelist H. Rider Haggard, himself an ardent amateur Egyptologist, reversed the trope of the mummy being likened to artwork in his short story Smith and the Pharaohs, published in 1912. And instead of noting the sexual allure of a statuesque mummy, he creates a protagonist who instead falls in love with a plaster cast of a sculpted head of an Egyptian lady, which is in the British Museum. So we have a number of removals from the actual subject. But lo and behold, he goes to the Cairo Museum and he sees the ghost of the Egyptian lady, and she looks exactly like the sculpted head, and he is in love with her. And when the ghost appears, she conforms to the popular representation of the female mummy as fair-skinned and dark-haired, as we've seen before. And the mummy, meanwhile, has been burned, and so all that physically remains of her are bone fragments, some small white regular teeth, and one of her hands. And prior to this, the protagonist appears apprehensive about the prospect of finding the mummy. It hurt him to reflect that the owner of yonder sweet, alluring face must have become a mummy long, long before the Christian era, and he justifies that opinion by saying mummies did not strike him as attractive, which shouldn't be surprising, but in this kind of fiction it is, because mummies are attractive. So when he finds the hand, he is pleased to discover that it is somewhat paradoxically withered and yet perfect, a woman's little hand, and of course it's most delicately shaped, paper white, and with long fingers and almond-shaped nails. And there are lots of other mummies in Haggard's story in the Cairo Museum. And unlike this mummified hand with its paper skin, they have parchment skin. So there's a contrast between the withered and the highly textured and the kind of yellowed and this perfect, white, smooth and yet withered hand, which doesn't really make sense in our world but does in Haggard's. And again, this hand, like the hand of Stoker's Queen Terror, is removed by grave robbers who take fragments of jewellery at the same time. So it's given a kind of financial value that you don't get with the male mummy at all. You don't get people stealing male mummies and equating them with gold or equating them with ivory and marble. Certainly, as Nicholas Daly states, and as these examples reveal, in mummy fiction, the masculine consumer enjoys the feminised object in any way he sees fit. Mummies were, after all, part of Victorian commodity culture. Rather troublingly, however, this often results in literary characters falling in love, or at least finding themselves sexually attracted to, objects that are essentially human corpses. This state of infatuation often comes about after the ancient Egyptian woman is disrobed, or in the case of the mummy unwrapped, an act that Bradley Dean describes as imperial striptease. Before the public unrolling of mummies became fashionable in the 1830s and 1840s, they were conducted by men and for all male audiences. Performed in secret, participants were very much aware of the titillating potential inherent to these undertakings. The unwrapping of the ancient female body is not only voyeuristic, it is verging on necrophiliac. Justifying this perversion in fiction, then, is the female mummy's lifelike beauty, implying that she is close to being revived by science, magic, or the fairy tale kiss. If life can be restored, then attraction is defensible. Haggard makes a particularly interesting case study, as by the time he wrote Smith and the Pharaohs, he had long been famous for his more major work with an ancient Egyptian flavour, She, first serialised between 1886 and 1887 in the graphic, and then later published as a novel. Although the eponymous She is not a mummy, she appears swathed in material from head to foot in both the text and accompanying illustrations. And so the newspaper version and the novel version have different pictures, but they're similar, and these are the ones from the graphic, the original pictures. And they clearly demonstrate the erotic nature of the unwrapping process in its full glory. So perhaps it should be unsurprising, then, that it was not long before these fictions of imperial striptease found their way into other art forms. The uncanny nature of bodies which looked to be statues, or at least seemed to be dead but may at any time begin to move, was harnessed in early moving pictures. Films such as Georges Méliès' Le Monstre saw a skeletal mummy transformed into a beautiful woman and back again through Egyptian magic. I think I may have to get up at this point to start this film. So this film was produced in 1903 and it's about 2.5 minutes long. It's on YouTube if anyone wants to watch it. But I have the last 30 seconds of it to show you, just to see the kind of culture that was emerging around ancient Egypt in the early days of cinema. So, fingers crossed it works. Okay, so the magician has raised the skeleton up as a ghost and it dances around. The lover is on the right and he's horrified to see his former lover's body turned into a phantom. On goes the sheet. There's a lot of stage magic influences, some camera trickery, and she's revived and wonderful. The lover is thrilled. But then the sheet goes back on. She's thrown into the lover's arms and she's a skeleton again. And he despairs. So again here we have a narrative of revival, wrapping and unwrapping. And while the ancient Egyptian female body appears to be restored, she is doomed to ultimately return to passivity. More controversial and kind of contradicting the theme in literature and film and art was a stage performance in 1907, where the French writer Colette starred in a pantomime at the Moulin Rouge. Entitled Rêve d'Égypte, Dream of Egypt, it featured herself decked out in revealing Egyptian-inspired costume and gold dust concealed underneath large quantities of ribbon. This was then unravelled by her lesbian lover, who was playing the part of a male Egyptologist. And you can see in the top left corner, that's her lover dressed as a man. And you can imagine how shocking this was when, after unwrapping the mummy, there was a lesbian kiss, and there was a resulting riot. The police were called and it was shut down. There were supposed to be 10 performances and only the first one ever happened. So this was unusual. Unusual. And perhaps people would have been more okay with it if the kiss hadn't awakened the mummy. I don't know. But it does go against the grain of what happens in literature at this point. So in this context, the female mummy had rejected her categorisation as artefact and revealed herself on stage as a being with transgressive sexual appetites. Her body, tantalisingly enhanced and seeking both male and female approval, is valuable for its beauty rather than what it might reveal about ancient Egyptian civilization. In performances such as these, and sparked by contemporary literature that romanticised and glamorised acts of unwrapping, the ancient Egyptian female body surpassed its definition as object and became an active sexual force. So to bring this towards something of a conclusion, there's one particularly symbolic way in which the female mummy resists objectification. And in many of the fictional tales I've covered here, there is a specific focus on the hand, which, as Nolwenn Currie has established, is more often than not in mummy fiction symbolic of marriage. H. Rider Haggard and Bram Stoker both use the image of the severed mummified hand as indicative of marital intentions in their fiction. So in the alternate ending of Stoker's The Jewel of Seven Stars, the male and female protagonists marry, with the woman wearing Queen Terra's robe and jewels on her wedding day. The problem with this ending, though, is that the female protagonist and the mummified queen are almost entirely physically identical, and there's some sort of psychic connection which makes itself apparent throughout the novel. So when the marriage takes place, it's unclear as to whether or not the queen has entered into the heroine's body and is marrying the protagonist herself and is exerting her power in that way. And in Haggard, Smith and the Pharaohs, there is a mysterious switching of rings between the ghost and the protagonist's hands after their spectral encounter, where the symbolism, I don't think, can be any more transparent, the exchanging of rings mimicking the exchanging of rings in the wedding ceremony. And in a contemporary story, Iris, a Mystery by Mrs. H.D. Everett, published under the pseudonym Theo Douglas in 1896. The protagonist elopes with a mummified princess who has been revived, but only to find her name fading slowly on the marriage certificate. And as the name fades, she also fades until she disappears. And he's found clutching the mummified body in its grotesque state rather than the perfectly preserved state. So ultimately, avoiding marriage as an act of ownership, the female body is destroyed, dismembered, disintegrating, fading like ghosts, or in the case of Haggard's She, burning up within a magical column of fire. Bodies once encountered as flawless sex objects are doomed to be destroyed. The possibility of romance is almost universally revealed to be an unattainable fantasy as the object is removed or removes herself from existence. Thank you.